I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Atheism has had a big couple of years. So-called new atheists like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins have sold a lot of books criticizing religion as untrue or out of step or even destructive. But not everyone agrees, not even all atheists, it turns out. The philosopher Alain de Botton is in fact arguing for an atheism 2.0 that actually draws on the best parts of religions, especially when it comes to education and art and architecture and community. He says it's time to acknowledge what in religion is good, even if, as he believes, it isn't true. Is this a way forward for respectful dialogue and mutual appreciation, or an insult to faithful and unbelievers alike? Religion for atheists? That's ahead on Up to Date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away this week. I'm Brian Ellison. What do you do if you don't believe in God, but you love Christmas carols? What if you think the supernatural is hogwash, but still long for a connection with others that's stronger than watching the same TV shows? What if you can't bear a house of worship, but still want to find a meeting place more meaningful than Walmart? Our guest today believes you can have it both ways, that there is no need for atheists to deny the good things that religion has brought the world in morality and ritual, in art and architecture. In fact, he says, atheism could take some religious practices and make them their own. Their godless, deity-free, totally humanistic own. Alain de Botton is the author of How Proust Can Change Your Life, and most recently of Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. He joins us this morning from the studios of Living on Earth in Somerville, Massachusetts. Alain de Botton, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to have you here. So what leads you, a committed atheist, to want to write a book and give talks about religion?
Well, I think, you know, the world's been really divided, say, the last 10, 15 years into two camps, you know, the believers and the non-believers. And it's been a pretty tense and sometimes dispiriting standoff with believers looking at atheists and feeling sorry for them for being damned, and atheists looking rather with the kind of air of superiority upon the religious and thinking them to be narrow-minded or even stupid. This kind of standoff doesn't appeal to me. And I suppose I've been brought up as an atheist, and without trying to be an atheist or without denying religiosity, I simply have ended up in an atheist position. And yet with age, I realize that many of the things that religious people get up to hold a deep interest and appeal for me. And this is an odd position to be in, because you can get shot at from both sides. You know, religious people will go, hang on a minute, you know, don't take an interest in us unless you're going to sign up to everything. And an atheist will say, particularly, you know, there's a brand out there of very, very militant atheists. And they will say, you know, in the words of Christopher Hitchens' book, Why Religion Poisons Everything. Everything. Right. In other words, that religion is the source of all evil. So an atheist who says, look, you know, I don't believe, but I'm willing to take a, you know, complex and thorough look at many of the concepts and rituals of religion, in a weird way, that's a very isolated position to be in. But anyway, nevertheless, it felt important for me to do that, and I've written the book, and I'm glad to see that they're actually, you know, I'm not totally alone in this. There are quite a lot of people out there, but they're slightly the silent, if not majority, a silent segment.
Sure. Do you think that the Christopher Hitchens, the Richard Dawkins of the world, that they actually would disagree with you that there is good in religion?
Absolutely. I've already been in a fight with Dawkins on this. And, you know, for all his work as a scientist, Dawkins, he is an incredibly narrow-minded man when it comes to religion. And he literally insists that religion is nothing but a source of evil. And he goes on and on about paedophile priests, the Spanish Inquisition, you know, the corruption of the clergy, the, you know, invasion of Latin America by troops of the Spanish Empire. You know, every atrocity that's been committed in the name of religion seems to someone like Dawkins like it's happening right now, all the time, everywhere. You know, this seems like a mad and wild exaggeration. And it seems so important to redress the balance.
And yet at the same time, you, as you say, you sort of find yourself in the middle. The, even the subtitle of your book, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion, might seem a little offensive to the religious, that you want to use it.
Absolutely. Because, you know, I can understand. They will say, you know, what's going on here? You're saying you're interested in, I don't know, the emotion of compassion, but you're not going to take the resurrection on board. Or you're interested in, you know, Zen Buddhist notions of friendship, but you're not going to look at reincarnation. Or, you know, you like the Jewish Day of Atonement, but you're not going to believe the literal story of Genesis. And I can understand that this seems like that worst of all things, which is a pick-and-mix approach. But I have to admit that that is precisely what I'm interested in, a pick-and-mix approach, because if you believe, as atheists do, that essentially humans arrived at religious ideas, then religions take their place among other works of mankind, where we more naturally pick and mix among them. I mean, we do this naturally with literature, with music, with film. You know, imagine if you like the Beatles and somebody said, well, I hope you're listening only to the Beatles and I hope you're, you know, you're not missing out any single track because, you know, this is the source of everything. That would seem unnatural. So as an atheist, I feel that I can naturally practice that sort of approach with a variety of religions. So I'm both highly respectful, but I can see that a certain kind of believer might take offense. And I think that would be unfortunate, but, you know, I can see that.
Sure.
Mind you, I have to say, if I was a believer, I would much rather meet someone who was an atheist and said, look, I'm interested in respectful and engaged with your religion, than somebody like Dawkins, who said, you know, your religion is a childish fairy tale.
Sure, sure. I wonder if this, in fact, is something we want to explore this hour, is whether there is common ground here for the religious and the unreligious. I should mention that Alain de Botton is speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday night, at 7:30 in the Woodruff Auditorium at the Kansas Union on the KU campus in Lawrence. He's part of the Hall Center for the Humanities lecture series, and that's free and open to the public. You can find more information on our website, which is kcur.org. So I want to get to some of your central idea. If it's not through the actions of a divine being or the supernatural, why did humans cause religion to come into being as you see it?
I think that religion is a response to human vulnerability, to the incredible difficulty of getting through this life unscathed and unharmed. It's a response to our fears, our longings for friendship, are the terrible difficulty of living together in a community and yet our desire to do so. Religions wrestle with human aggression. They encourage, in their best moments, human kindness and tolerance and forgiveness. Religions were invented to educate people, to transmit wisdom down the generations so that one generation wouldn't simply be ignorant of the achievements of their forefathers, forebearers. What else have religions done? I mean, they've engaged with art and architecture to transmit lessons and instruction. I mean, one way to look at religions is they are giant machines for educating what I call, without any supernatural inclinations, our souls. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is the inner part of us, the precious part of us, the seat of our true personality. They are educational machines.
But if they're based on something that you think is untrue, I mean, if the fundamental idea behind the religion is wrong, why would you embrace ideas and practices that have seemingly sprung from that sort of fundamental idea, whether it be God or God's love or something like that?
Yeah. First of all, I would reject the use of the word wrong, because I don't think that religions are wrong. Indeed, the whole idea of right and wrong seems off. I'm not somebody who says, you know, this thing is wrong. I simply say a certain set of beliefs might not appeal to me or might not seem plausible to me. So I keep the thing subjective, because I think that assertion of right and wrong is very dangerous and is the root of sort of intolerance. So there are aspects of religion related to supernatural doctrines that don't seem so plausible to me. Nevertheless, there are all kinds of emphases, concepts within religions which do. I mean, let me give you an example. So religions, you know, in Catholicism, for example, you find a lot of emphasis on the idea of original sin. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that concept both has a divine, supernatural origin, and yet for an atheist is a very rich and complex idea with which one can get all kinds of, you know, good thoughts and good approaches. For me, the concept of original sin is really the notion that we are broken, we are incomplete, we are vulnerable, we are not perfectible, that humans are not perfectible. And this is a major dividing line between traditionally the secular world and the religious world. The secular world believes that, you know, with a little bit more help from Apple and a little few more years of scientific development, you know, human life will crack it and we will become absolutely perfect. This seems such a dangerous, truly, and I say this as an atheist, impious approach. I much prefer the religious view, the Catholic view, but you find it in other faiths too, that fundamentally there's stuff wrong with us. And so what we need is charity and forgiveness, two central emotions. And that in a relationship, two people entering, this seems so much safer to have that approach. If you see a couple getting together and both of them think, well, we're great, we're terrific, we're young and beautiful, and we're kind of perfect, that's a dangerous relationship. But if you see two people getting together and they say, look, both of us are kind of broken, we're going to need an awful lot of charity and forgiveness in order to live together, I think, well, that's going to be a good relationship. So that's just an example of how, as an atheist, all these concepts, like pride, like charity, like forgiveness, these operate. You know, I'm a philosopher by training, and philosophically, you can pull these out of the doctrinal context in which they first originate, and they function beautifully, and they explain an awful lot about human nature.
We're talking with Alain de Botton. He's the author of Religion for Atheists. He's speaking tomorrow night in Lawrence about his new book, about this idea that atheism can draw on the best of religion. Alain, one of the things that you mention, actually one of the several concepts you cover, is the concept of community. In fact, it's one of the places you start in your book, the idea that religion can teach everyone, including atheists, about how to develop and maintain and strengthen a sense of community. And you offer a very extended look, a mostly admiring look, at the Roman Catholic Mass. What is so admirable about the Catholic Mass?
Well, all religions have a certain time of the week, or of the year, of the day, when a group of strangers are brought together in a place and they are bonded together through the offices of a priest or a divine interceder, and something miraculous happens that strangers turn into friends. And we don't have that in the secular world. You know, the secular world is full of bars and restaurants, but we don't go into bars and restaurants and come out, on the whole, certainly in the UK, with friends. You know, these are places where you have community, but you don't have friendship. In other words, you have groups of people together, but you don't have true bondings. Whereas religions seem to be more intelligent. They gather us together, and they seem aware that about 1 millimeter beneath the sort of permafrost of our exterior, where we wander through the world slightly grim-faced and unfriendly, there's an awful lot of sociability and a desire to give ourselves to others. But we don't get a chance to do that because we're worried. The media tells us that other people are dangerous and murderers and robbers and swindlers. So we kind of, we keep ourselves to ourselves. But within, the church or the mosque or the temple, that sociability is let loose. What you might say is that religions function as hosts. You know, the word host is, of course, a religious word.
Right.
But, we know hosts from parties, don't we? You know, a bad party has a bad host. And what does the bad host do? The bad host does not know how to bring out the humanity of the guests to one another. So everybody stands in their corner with a drink. Again, this happens a lot in my native England. probably less so in Kansas. But
no, we're all very social here in Missouri.
Good. So, but essentially that is what religion is doing. Also, it has to be said, the miracle, and you find this especially in Christianity, is that most social gatherings in the secular world, within a few seconds, somebody says to you, "What do you do?" Right? What do you do? And that question is really trying to read where that person stands in the modern economy. And the person's value is, however much we may fight it, somehow pegged to their earthly status. And the genius of Christianity has always been to divide earthly from heavenly status. Now, you could say, am I talking to an atheist? Of course. As an atheist, one can totally understand what's going on with that division that you find in, you know, St. Augustine, the earthly city, the heavenly city. Really what's going on is a division between what an atheist might call the true self, the psychological self, the rich inner self that's there in us as children, and then on the other hand, the self of power, of money, of status. And to keep that distinction alive and to be able to create a community that once a week or so gathers simply around the true self, that's a beautiful and really important idea, especially in a world which otherwise is pretty chilly and pretty money and status focused.
Well, right. You've suggested that capitalism really has pretty much the opposite message from religion when it comes to the meaning of community and how to and the promotion of community.
Absolutely. The two run completely in opposite directions because the capitalist community is one based on power and the religious community is one based on love. I mean, that's the ideal. And I think the reason why, you know, religious communities are especially important in the modern world is that the rest of the world is extremely tough. You know, it's a windy place out there in, you know, the capitalist landscape, and people have a tremendous longing to be evaluated for something other than what they have done, more for how they feel, how they are, what they want to be. It's terribly hard to be judged by what's on your business card, because many of us, we haven't managed to bring our soul in line with our business card. A lot of what is richest and most complex about us has not been put on a commercial footing. So we need to be looked at with charity. And it's hard for that to happen outside of personal relationships or often relationships that are governed in some ways by religion.
If you want to join the conversation, I want to invite you to do that at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. If you're an atheist, have you found ways in which you can embrace rather than critique religion? And if you are religious, how do you feel about the progress and fruit of your faith being appropriated by those who don't have that faith? Call us at 235-2888. Bill in Grandview, welcome to the conversation.
Good morning. This is very comforting to hear this. Sometimes I feel, as I have moved through my own life, that I am in a minority and probably am, that I think that all theologies are mythologies. They're just another desire for somebody else to give power to somebody so they can tell them what to do. To your earlier question about why I thought of the question of why religions came about, my own personal conclusion came about more to the point that religions do add a structure by suggesting the punishment by a higher being to civilization. Economies cannot and civilizations cannot grow in anarchy. There has to be some structure and form where you can actually walk down the street and not worry about whether or not that person next to you is going to grab a big sword, stick it through your heart, and then take your money. There has to be some control and structure.
And Bill, you're lifting that up as a positive contribution that religion has made.
I think that is the reason why religions came into existence. I think people who were not as powerful, who were not as confrontational, came across the concept of a divine person who said, if you do this, somebody else is going to punish you. It may not be me.
Okay.
And I think that's a desire to control environment. Now, to his other point about the altruistic values of human beings and the other part of the discussion you had with him, I think religion does bring that out and strengthen that point. But I think originally it came from having a bigger policeman than you are to try to control the impulses of people.
A desire to control. Well, okay, let's ask Alain de Botton about that. Is Bill right? Is that why religion came to be? And is that a good thing?
If I can look at it at the present moment, you know, we do have police forces, we have law and order, etc. So do we still need that ethical framework that religions propose? The way I look at it is that religions often propose a code of behavior that emphasizes things like kindness and forgiveness and goodness, right? Now, I think that most of us sign up to these ideas in theory, right? In theory, we all want to be kind, we all want to be good in theory, things we're not. And the reason we're not is because we're under stress, we're under pressure, there are a lot of things going on, and sometimes at the end of the day, when we haven't been that nice with those around us or whatever, in our heart of hearts we think, I wish I could have been better. Now, I think what religions do is they try and stimulate that side of us that aims to be good. And there's obviously a model of religion which is kind of top-down authoritarian, like you be good or else you're going to go to hell and you'll roast in the flames. But I think a more sophisticated religion goes like this. It says, I know you want to be good, you've told me you want to be good, and I'm on hand to support the best sides of you in your attempt to be good. In other words, it's not an authority contradicting your real wishes. It's an outside observer encouraging the best sides of you to dominate your own personality. And I think that's different. It's rather like you feel like, let's say you're an alcoholic, right? You don't really want to drink and be an alcoholic, and somebody comes along and takes the keys to the drinks cabinet, right? That person is in a way honoring your freedom. They're not limiting your freedom. That's a classic distinction that you find in Catholic theology. The freedom to do anything you like at all, which is not really a freedom worth having, and the freedom to live a good life. That's the really important freedom. Now, that second freedom could be compatible with at certain times being told that, no, you can't drink or watch pornography or, you know, beat someone up, because actually that would be a betrayal, not of the law, although that too, but it's really a betrayal of you. It's not allowing you to be who you want to be when you're feeling calm and rested and, you know, looking at your life and wondering where you want to go.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with Alain de Botton. As we continue to talk about the ways that religion influences and empowers some idea of community that atheists or that the secular world can grab onto, you really focus in your book for a long extent on the idea of eating together and the way that not just Christianity and Judaism, but many religions focus on a meal or sharing a meal. And you like that idea as one that could be embraced in a more secular way, right?
That's right. I mean, it's striking that all the major faiths break bread together at a certain time. They gather groups of people and they always have room for the stranger. And food has a role to play. It's a sort of primary symbol of hospitality. And at the most advanced idea, the thought is, you're sitting around a table with people, you may not agree with them on everything. You may, they may seem different and strange in many ways, but you will tolerate them. And toleration is such a key idea. You only tolerate people who in some ways, their views are not your own. And that's why toleration is a kind of spiritual task. Toleration would be easy if we agreed with everybody, but we don't. So the task is, how can you tolerate somebody whose views you don't particularly at first like? And the idea is, around the table, that toleration is made more possible. You share, you accept the other person for the fact that they're a bit different, etc. And it's a beautiful thing. And I can't help but look at the modern world where, you know, we've got restaurants and bars, etc. But how rarely there is that feeling of kind of fellowship which you have around.
Because you come in together, and you come in with the people you were with anyway, and you leave with them. You don't really interact.
That's right. You don't really meet the stranger. You know, people have said to me things like, what about social media? Surely we've got loads of communities now because everybody's on Facebook and Twitter and all the rest of it. And my answer to that is, the modern world tends to drive people into silos based around shared interests. It's like, you like ice hockey and, you know, I like fly fishing. So everybody gets together in their little groups. What's more interesting and more challenging, I suppose, about the religious idea of community is you get together with people, some of whom you've got absolutely nothing in common with other than they're another human being. And so the kind of challenge is, can you see the humanity in the stranger who at first looks a bit weird, doesn't share any of your tastes, doesn't do fly fishing or whatever it is, and that's really intriguing in a world that's otherwise so focused on, you know, shared tastes.
Mm-hmm. So the particular religious idea you latch onto is one of the early Christian practices called an agape feast. Explain what that is and how you would sort of implement that in a more secular way.
Well, before the Mass was a Mass, it was a meal called an agape feast, where followers of Christ would gather every Friday and would have a meal together and invite people. It was a kind of open table. They'd have a simple meal, and they would share and remember the lessons of Christ.
Agape means love. It's a Greek word for love.
Exactly. So reading that, I thought, you know, how charming, how different from the modern alienated world. And I tried to imagine, you know, imagine if we had agape restaurants where you could drop in and similarly, based around tolerance and love and friendship, strangers could break bread together. So I think there are all kinds of ways in which the secular world is only just catching up with the inventiveness, the creativity of religious rituals and maneuvers. And, you know, it's time, I think, that atheists got a bit more creative with how they manage themselves.
You're welcome to email your questions to us at updatedate@kcur.org. Is there room for new dialogue and respect between religion and atheism through atheists admiring the things that religion accomplishes without necessarily accepting the doctrine? Or is it hypocritical or disrespectful somehow to admire a place of worship like a church or synagogue or mosque or temple but reject the teachings that go inside? Email us at updatedate@kcur.org or call us at 235-2888. Rick in Overland Park. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, first I'd like to state that I am a dedicated Baptist Christian.
Thank you for that full disclosure, Rick.
But my point or my argument, your guest is surely familiar with Hobbes' State of the Natural Man.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And his treatise. And I would argue that Hobbes' treatise on natural man really gave the platform or framework from which Christianity or atheism stems from, giving a safe environment, and then religion came from that.
Okay. Maybe you can make that accessible to us. This is what you do for a living, Alain de Botton. How does Hobbes' theory of the state of man get us to this point of talking about religion?
Well, I think what your contributor is saying is that that religion, again, is a response to violence, that without religion we would be tearing at each other's throats. And I think I'm sure that at an early stage of human development, religion played an enormous role in encouraging the gentler sides of human beings. That has to be historically true and correct. I think we remain in need, probably, of having those sides you know, exercised and stimulated. You know, that we are people who forget to be good and kind, however good our intentions are. That's why religions don't just you know, tell us something once. They repeat lessons. You know, five times a day a religion might remind its people what they should believe in, how they should behave. It will use music and art and architecture. It will appeal to us through the senses. All of these are giant reminders of how to keep on a good track and how to keep society together.
Before we go to a break, I want to ask you about another area that gets a lot of attention in your book and in talks that I've heard you give about, and that is education and the role of religion in sort of educational history and how education has veered off the course that it maybe once was on. You talk about how if you showed up today at Harvard or Oxford, or let us assume the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and said, "I've come here because I'm in search of morality, guidance, and consolation. I want to know how to live." They would show you the way to the insane asylum, you say. But that wasn't always the case, was it?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, in the middle of the 19th century in England, church attendance fell off a cliff. People just simply were not going to churches in the, you know, the kind of numbers that their parents and grandparents had been to. And people started worrying, where was society going to find its guidance, its morality, its consolation? And an influential group said, well, a lot of this stuff could be available through culture. So culture could replace scripture. So people meant by this, you know, the dialogues of Plato, the plays of Shakespeare, the essays of Montaigne, the novels of Jane Austen. And it's on the back of that that there was an enormous expansion in the teaching at school and universities of the humanities. That's where, you know, the idea of English as a discipline that you could study at university level began. So culture replaces scripture. I think that's an interesting idea and a good idea and a wise idea. But again, as you said, if you showed up at any university in the United States and you said, "I've come to study because I want to be guided, I want to be moral, I want to be consoled, I want to lead a good life," people would think that was crazy. Or or they thought they'd think, oh, that's a bit religious. In other words, the modern secular education, vision of education, is of people who are basically kind of together. They sort of know how to live. You know, living's not a difficult thing. You know, you get married, you have a child, you watch your parents get older and die, you know, you look at your own mortality, eventually you have to get in the coffin and shut the lid, and basically it's easy to get through that. You know, you don't need any particular help. So there's an idea that, you know, and only people who read self-help books, well, they're stupid people. You know, that's the kind of modern elite view of education. Now, if you look at religion, the starting point is totally different. All the major faiths think that basically we're vulnerable, we're weak, we're only just holding it together, and we need help, because life is an incredibly arduous process to get through. How are we going to get through these challenges without help? And even though I don't necessarily agree with all the help that's on offer all the time in all the faiths, I'm very interested in this notion that we are vulnerable and we need wisdom and we need guidance. And I think this is something which we've tragically lost in the secular world, much to the confusion of young people who are routinely let down by their education and come out of education without a proper, you know, moral core or sense of meaning and guidance.
Okay, so in your view then, how would the non-religious person or the non-religious world read non-religious material religiously? How can they draw on the secular or the humanistic in the same way, with the same degree of devotion, the same sort of life transformation that religious material is offered to the religious?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the concept of a parable is right at the center of this, because if you think of what a parable is in the gospel, it is a story from which you pull out a lesson. And that lesson is meant to change and inspire and guide you. Now, all works of culture are potentially able to be read as parables. You know, you could read, take something like Tolstoy. I mean, he's a Christian writer, but take Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich. That is a parable. That is a parable about death and the meaning of life. Is it read as such on college courses? No. No, it's studied as a piece of, as an example of, Russian literature in the 19th century, various academic points. So, in other words, it is not looked to as a way to live. You know, when people read the novels of Jane Austen, who incidentally is, of course, another Christian writer, do they look at her as a writer of parables, of basically Christian parables about money and status? No, they don't. So there's a weird way in which the richness of culture has been denuded, has been denied by the way in which it's studied. You know, think of museums. You know, in museums, we've got fantastic works of art. Do we use them as religions used to use them, as devotional objects to guide and inspire? Not really.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk more with Alain de Botton about religion for atheists, about institutions, and about architecture and art. We'll also talk about his life as a philosopher who writes books for a popular audience. We'd also love to hear from you. You can write us online at UpToDate@KCUR.org. You can post something on KCUR's Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. Stay with us for local news headlines. I'm Brian Ellison, and you're listening to UpToDate on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away. I'm Brian Ellison. If you missed yesterday's conversation with the Techsperts about the new iPad and Google Fiber TV and the Facebook timeline and more, you can find that online at kcur.org. Also, join us tomorrow when we'll talk about a new look at the brief but significant presidency of JFK and the dangerous and amazing practice of cave diving. Join us tomorrow. Today we're talking with Alain de Botton about religion for atheists. That's the title of his newest book, and also of the talk he's giving tomorrow night at KU in the Hall Center's Humanities Lecture Series. That's free and open to the public, and you can find information on our website, kcur.org. You can also talk with him now. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888, with your questions about the intersection of atheism and religion and how you might suggest the two can or cannot exist. Let's talk to Frank in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a two-part question. First, to Mr. de Botton, I haven't quite finished your new book yet, so I don't know if you cover the questions I'm going to present in your last chapters, but I'm enjoying it. It reminds me a lot of your Consolation of Philosophy book. Question is two parts. First, the term atheist, I've heard one definition of it that actually dissects the word into atheistic, meaning that one does not believe in a theistic God, which is a God that directly interacts with the individual, which by my interpretation would mean you wouldn't necessarily mean that there isn't a higher spirit or necessarily a higher intelligence force. So I'd be interested in your definition of atheist. And second part is, as I read your book, I'm interpreting from what you're saying that the positive things you see in religion really seem to deal with the emotional sides of the individual, fear, love, insecurity, grief, anger, and trying to give guidance and how to deal with one's emotions, which, as you pointed out earlier, aren't necessarily addressed in other parts of our society.
Okay, so the first question then, how are you defining atheist here?
You know, I think there's no set definition. The definition is fluid and it moves around, and you're absolutely right. Under some definitions, it allows for, the word allows for the concept of a higher intelligence but not linked to any particular doctrines or faith. So the answer has to be personal. My own view is that I neither believe in you know, personal God connected to a faith, nor indeed to a concept of a higher intelligence. But that is a personal definition. And you know, as we've been seeing, there are atheists who loathe religion, and atheists who are very interested and very sympathetic to religion, of which I am one. So the term is flexible. I suppose like the word religious, which also allows for a huge range of positions.
Frank's other question was about whether the ways that you're saying religion adds value is appealing to sort of the emotional sides of religion.
Absolutely. I think the way I look at it is that religion structures our inner lives. It lends vital support for good tendencies in us that could otherwise be crushed. If you think of so many religious rituals, what they are is they're trying to get us to do things which, if we were left simply on our own, we'd have a bit of a hard time doing. I mean, take something like the Jewish festival of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. What that is a giant cycle of apology, where people on this day look inside themselves, see what they've done wrong, and then go and talk to others and admit their mistakes and are ready to listen with charity to the complaints of others. So it's a sort of giant apology. Now, all of us, you know, have got things to apologize for, but it's usually outside of religious structure really, really hard to do that apology because we're afraid, I don't know, that we'll sound ridiculous or that the other person will be so angry with us, or, you know, a whole host of things holds us back. And so the genius of the religious ritual is to perform a psychologically rich maneuver that we would have been cut off from had we not, you know, been part of that religion. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with your caller. Religions are helping us psychologically, you would say. And I suppose to a religious person, they would say, well, you know, the psychological is divine. So in that sense, you know, it's helping the divine part of us. But, you know, an atheist can translate that into the psychological, the healthy part of us.
Mm-hmm. We were talking a little bit earlier about education. And one of the things that you do, besides writing 10 books, is help run a school that you started in London called the School of Life. I'm curious what that is and if this in some way reflects this vision for a secular but religiously appreciative, I guess, education.
It's a little bit connected. What we do at the School of Life is look at some of the main challenges that people go through in their lives, be it, you know, relationships, children, work, parents, illness. These are the major hurdles. And we offer instruction and communal gatherings and lectures and sermons around these things.
You call them sermons?
Well, we call them secular sermons.
Okay.
Secular sermons. And we do that on purpose to signal. You see, what's the difference between a lecture and a sermon? A lecture sounds like it's just a sort of dispassionate laying out of some facts by a kind of professor with some students. No one really needs to know the answer with any urgency. A sermon is a much richer, more resonant word. So we use the term secular sermon because it shares with the sermon the desire to guide and inspire and exhort, which I think is a more interesting ambition to have. So we do that in relation to these big questions. And you know, we found a tremendous response. We have believers and non-believers. And I think people really enjoy a chance to kind of chew over these questions in a friendly and welcoming community.
I'm hesitant to ask this question, given what you've already said about the party question. What is it you do? But I am curious how you usually answer that question. I read a review of your work that referred to you casually as a pop philosopher. Would you embrace that title?
Well, I think, it's odd what I do, because really what I'm interested in is wisdom, right? And so what does wisdom mean? I guess wisdom is a part of knowledge, that part of knowledge that is not only true, but also effective, that actually has a change on the individual's life. Lots of knowledge doesn't. Lots of knowledge is cut off from kind of the individual and their dilemmas and problems. But there's a little part called wisdom, and you find wisdom scattered around. You find it in religion, you find it in literature, you find it in the arts, you find it in science. So it's everywhere.
And you've written books about many of those topics, actually. Travel,
yes,
and art and architecture.
Yeah, and so, in my many books, that's what I try and head for. And it's a kind of therapeutic approach to writing and to reading. I wrote a book a number of years ago now called How Proust Can Change Your Life. So Marcel Proust, the great French 19th century writer, almost a byword for irrelevance and kind of elite, almost snobbish kind of dilettantism. But what I try to argue is this guy's got some wisdom. He's got some answers. So I wrote this book, How Proust Can Change Your Life, which got me expelled from the university. The academics did not like it because
Really?
their answer was, what are you doing trying to use a great literary figure in order to help people's lives? And I said, well, surely that's what we should all be doing. And they said, no, the university has, scholarly aims in mind. And so, I slightly fell out with them there, because it seems to me absolutely important that in a world overrun by commercial messages and bad television and media that's constantly kind of dragging us down, that what we need is good, clear communication for writers. And, I always try and write books that can be read by absolutely everybody. If somebody comes up to me and says, I tried reading your book and it sounds a little bit, grand and special and technical, I think, well, I've messed up. I try and write books of the utmost kind of scholarly integrity, but very easy to read. That's what I'm always aiming for. And, so in a minor way, I'm trying to change the world, help people to live a little bit better, and help myself, more or less.
I know that one of your books is about architecture, and of course some folks may have seen you even on television talking about modern architecture. And this sort of brings us back to the topic at hand, because one of your chapters is devoted to religious architecture and the contributions that that has made to the world. Are you calling for just an honest recognition of that fact, which doesn't seem especially new or bold, or is there a particular secular outcome you'd like to see as a result of religious architecture?
Well, I think that even people who don't believe in religion tend to be very struck by the beauty and complexity of religious buildings. They are, the high points often of many religions. They are absolutely beautiful. Whether it's, a mosque or a temple, or it's a Zen Buddhist temple, or whether it's a synagogue or whatever, these places are often great places of beauty. Now, why do religions think that we need architecture? Why do they invest? Why do they spend all that money? The essential argument is, if the building is wrong, the person might be wrong. That, if you like, buildings are a branch of what we call mental health. That architecture plays a role in pulling us towards being the sort of people that we are at our best. And, you feel that sometimes when you walk into a giant church or cathedral, let's say. Sometimes you look up at the ceiling and you feel a feeling of awe, and you feel closer to some of the big ideas that are there in the religion. You feel your own ego be stilled. You feel that some of the things that were besetting you have, quietened down. So architecture has a very, very powerful impact, and religions have always known it, and that's why they've spent all this money.
Mm-hmm.
What strikes a secular person like myself is, well, what are we doing? What are we building that's in any way comparable to this? Are we doing any of the things that religions do? And on the whole, no. I mean, sure, we have libraries and swimming pools and the odd, community center. But in terms of trying to use architecture to touch our souls, to guide our souls, to create those quintessential religious feelings like calm and contemplation and gratitude and awe. Do we have buildings that set out to do this? Well, not really, you know, and I think it's a pity. And if I was ruling the world, I'd think that we should, you know, and that non-believers, just like believers, should also have some spaces where some of these great things, these great emotions, could be more visible. Take planetariums, you know. Some people have said to me, well, we have these places already, and they're called planetariums. And there is that feeling sometimes. You go into a planetarium, you look at the sky, you get a sense of the heavenly bodies, and you have that quintessentially, you know, it's very close to religion because it's all about feeling small in the vastness. But the thing is, those planetariums exist for a reason, to educate us in science. And that's maybe not what we're after sometimes. When we go to those science museums or planetariums, often we're not doing this because we want to, you know, join NASA or pick up some scientific knowledge. We're doing it for the same reasons that people go to churches. In other words, we want to feel a sense of awe. We want the ego to be stilled and to be put in a wider context. But these institutions often don't recognize that. So I would love there, for example, to be a planetarium that would not be emphasizing the idea that we're all going to learn about, you know, distant galaxies and, you know, exactly which galaxy is called what, you know, because the guys at NASA can do that. It would be a slightly different ambition, related but different, which is really to use the spectacle of the heavens in ways in which, you know, religions have done this, i.e. right. to create a feeling of awe.
And to make the person feel small.
To make the person feel small. And that feeling of feeling small is so important. You know, we sometimes think, you know, let's say you go into a hotel or a bar or something and you say, that person made me feel small. That's the most horrible feeling, when another human makes you feel small. But there's a nice way of feeling small, which is when you go out at night under the stars, or you look at a glacier or the wide open ocean, or, you know, whatever it is, and you suddenly see that your own issues are set in a broader context. And religions do that. They constantly play with scale. And that's something the secular world, the atheist world, is really bad at doing. Human beings loom too large in their own imaginations. Once you take God out of the equation, you know, humans become gods, as it were, and it becomes the worship of other humans and their achievements. You know, I was just in New York City, and you really get a sense of that. You look around, what's making you feel small? It's, you know, it's the temples of other humans, as it were.
Right.
And that leads to anxiety and a constant striving of the ego, etc.
Well, and so shrines to capitalism and to commerce more than to anything.
That's right. So I think, you know, there's space for contemporary architects to look at some of these themes, to look at what religions have done very intelligently down the centuries in relation to architecture, and in some ways to imitate, learn from it. You know, there are some people. There's this wonderful guy, James Turrell. I don't know if you know him, this land artist who's working out of Arizona. And he's creating a massive, he's hollowing out a volcano and creating what he calls a sky space, where we can contemplate, you know, the sky. And it's a kind of non-denominational space, and it'll be a beautiful space. That's the sort of thing I'm talking about, that somewhere where, you know, be you an atheist or a believer, that kind of space is playing on some themes that religious architects have been handling for centuries.
Sure. Let's take a call from Chris in Lawrence. Chris, good morning. Welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You had a comment?
Oh, yes. As I was listening about to the all the when you were talking about the idea of studying using our art and philosophy and, you know, using culture to sort of give the secular world an idea. I'm trying to remember exactly how you put it, but as you were just talking about that, I'm about to celebrate 25 years from graduation from a 4-year liberal arts institution in college in Minnesota that's based on Benedictine values and Catholicism. And I had no idea until I joined a study group through my church how differently I ended up seeing the world coming out of that, and how much you can learn, how much you can learn and actually strengthen in your own faith if that's what you know, where the direction that takes you from those things. And I didn't realize until I've been in this group for a few weeks and didn't realize how different I feel, kind of like a fish out of water. And it's so wonderful to hear that.
Chris, thank you, Chris, for your call. Appreciate that perspective. Another question we have from Richard by email, and he writes essentially a question wondering whether your philosophies on religion differ when you look outside Western religion, at Hinduism and Buddhism and pantheism, for example.
Well, one of the things, one of the religions I do look at in my book is Buddhism. I didn't know much about Buddhism, but I was very curious about it. I think what's striking is just how many areas of congruence there are between Western and Eastern religions, which really leads one to think that humanity is a, you know, is a thing that that is pretty united across all sorts of ethnic differences. If you think about Buddhism's teachings on compassion, on love, on charity, I mean, they could have been pulled out of the Bible. It is extraordinary to witness. There are some wonderful local touches. I mean, I love the way, for example, there are some rituals that don't exist in the West. Take something like the Zen Buddhist tea ceremony. It's a lesson in friendship. It's a moment when a group of people gather to have some green tea together in a highly ritualized way. It's very serious. Right at the core of Zen Buddhism, it's as serious as the Mass is for a Catholic, but it's a charming ritual that, again, as in so many religions, uses a physical action, drinking something, eating something, to spur on a kind of inner change. They also go in for gravel raking, calligraphy, you know, wonderful things. But the themes, the underlying themes, are very, very similar. And you find love, and you find charity, and you find forgiveness, and you find sweetness. You know, these are themes that keep cropping up, and that's very heartwarming to see the united nature, sure, of these themes.
About 10 seconds left. My question is, what would you like to see come about as a result of this book? How would you like people to live differently or do something different?
I would like atheists to recognize that religions are intermittently far too complex, beautiful, intelligent to be abandoned merely to those who happen actually to believe in them. They're for all of us, not least non-believers.
That's Alain de Botton. His newest book is Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. He speaks tomorrow evening at 7:30 at KU's Woodruff Auditorium in the Kansas Union as part of the Hall Center Humanities Lecture Series. Alain de Botton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That event, by the way, is free and open to the public, and you can find out more on our website, which is kcur.org. You can also find an excerpt of Alain's book and biographies of all our guests, as well as links to our previous broadcasts. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, we'll take a new look at the brief but significant presidency of JFK, and also the dangerous and amazing practice of cave diving. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. Steve Kraske is away, but I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.